history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there, amazing stories, remarkable stories, just waiting to be told. We'll just take a little time to ask some questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We really want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Fresno, California, at the beautiful Veterans Home of California with 100-year-old Jane Boot. When did you turn 100, Jane?
December 25th.
You've been a Christmas baby for 100 years.
Yes.
How did you feel about that when you were young?
Well, the problem is, I never got any birthday presents because it was Christmas and everybody got Christmas presents. So I kind of got lost in the shuffle.
And you were the youngest of five kids, so you were already at the bottom of that totem pole.
Right.
How about this Christmas, though? Did number 100 work out okay for you?
It worked out fine. Really had a nice party.
Yeah, you even had a congressman here, I think, to do some special things for you?
Yes, they gave me a plaque, you know, all the stuff.
Well, people are going to hear you, and I don't know if they're going to believe you're 100. And I know they wouldn't believe it watching you walk around here at the California Veterans Home either. But I want to talk about way back when you were that little girl growing up in Erie, Pennsylvania. What was life like there in the 20s and 30s?
Oh, my. Well, we were all poor. But my mother, once we were grown, my mother said to me, "Did you ever think you were poor when you were young?" And I said, "No, everybody was poor." What was poor? But we certainly didn't have much money. Most of the dads worked, like, they almost all worked for General Electric in that area of Erie. But they put them on just part-time, so at least everybody had something. So that it wasn't too bad, but you knew that you didn't get things as rapidly as you did later. Yes, we knew we were deprived.
What about as the youngest child in a family of seven? You're the baby girl. Do you remember having some hopes and dreams of someday, here's what I want to do with my life?
I think my mother prejudiced me. She always wanted to be a nurse. So I think when I was born, she thought she could have her vision realized through me because she couldn't do it. So I think she kept telling me all my young life that's what I wanted to be, because I never remember being wanting to be anything else. So I from very, very young, planned to be a nurse.
And that's what you would do in World War II. People have heard quite a few times probably that 16 million Americans were in uniform during World War II. Maybe they don't hear so much about the fact that 300,000 of them were women in uniform during World War II, and you were one of those. But if I'm doing the math here, 100 years old, you were probably becoming a nurse before the war started, right?
Yes.
So you got done with high school, and where'd you go?
I went to Pittsburgh to Allegheny General Hospital, went through their three-year nurses training. That's when they still had three-year nurses training. And then from there, I went into service.
You know, I'm curious, now that I think of it, talk about high school. You know, today, I mean, I have two daughters right now that are teenagers, and the opportunities for young women in high school, I mean, they can play just about any sport they want. They have all these different activities. What about for you as a high schooler in the late 1930s? What kind of opportunities did you have?
Well, first, we lived about as far away from the high school as you could get. We lived within a couple of blocks of the little town of Wesleyville. So we were right on the edge of Erie, and it was difficult for us to be engaged in activities. So I really didn't get into any activities in high school, you know, because we'd have to go on the bus to go to school, and if we stayed after school, you know, we'd probably have to walk home, and that was our distance, a couple miles, so that was too much.
Especially when there's some lake effect snow happening, right?
and a lot of snow to plow through.
Well, I was thinking too. I mean, if that's your situation, you're out of town like that, and you've got four older siblings. Did they do all the chores, or did you have some tough chores that you had to handle as a young lady?
I didn't see I was very favored, but after we were adults, my siblings all said that I was the youngest and I didn't have to do anything. They thought I was very favored, but I didn't feel that way.
What was the toughest chore you had to do around the house?
Probably dry the dishes.
And so you get through high school and you go to nursing school there in Pittsburgh. So your thought was, I'll just be a nurse, work in a hospital and help people heal. Did you find fulfillment in that early?
Yes, I thought just of hospital nursing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how were you enjoying that?
I didn't really care much for it. I didn't care that much for that. I guess that's why I went in the service. But of course, when we finished nurses training, they were looking for nurses in the service all the time. So they practically were at the door waiting for us.
Well, everyone I've interviewed over the years who was alive during this time period seems to remember something about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember that day and how you found out the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Oh, yeah. I was sitting in the dining room. No, I was sitting in the kitchen. There's a little table area right at the end of the kitchen before you went in the dining room. I was sitting there when I heard it on the radio. I heard some usual, we had all a bunch of radio men then that were always getting the news out. And I think that's when I heard it. I think I went in the service in March of 42. I stayed at the hospital in Pittsburgh and worked and then went in the service.
So let's stick with December of 41 here for a moment. So you hear this on the radio, and people all over the country are hearing this on the radio. What was your reaction to that? How did that make you feel, or how stunning was that news?
It was a real surprise to me because when you're in training, it's almost like you get cut off from the world. You know, your own little world is where you are all the time practically, except a few times that you got to go home to visit. So it came as a real surprise to me, Pearl Harbor. But my immediate reaction was, you know, hey, I got to be part of this.
So you didn't wait very long, just a few months later.
Yes.
Was there a recruiting pitch or posters?
Yeah, there were recruiters came around to interview all the nurses graduated because, of course, they were trying to get them to come in the service.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I decided to go in.
Did you think about maybe being a Navy nurse?
No, but if I'd have seen the Navy nurses' hats before I went, I'd have gone in the Navy. They had beautiful hats.
So it was the Army for you.
Yes.
And how did your family feel about that?
I think they were pleased. They seemed to be proud of me.
So March of 42, you joined the Army. What did they do with you? Where'd they send you?
To Iceland.
It's not what I expected to hear.
Iceland. We had, Iceland was in a rather strategic area of the North Atlantic, and the Germans, of course, recognized that right away. And in order to keep the Germans out of Iceland, the British went in. Well, then things got hot for the British, and they had to pull all their troops back to Britain, so the Americans went in that summer. So we got to go to that lovely island.
Did they fly you there, or did you have to take a ship and watch out for the U-boats in the North Atlantic?
We took a ship.
Yeah, what was that like?
And it was terrible. We were all over the place. It took us weeks to get there. And once you got there, of course, you always said the ship before you or the ship after you got torpedoed. But there was a lot of torpedoing, yes, at that time.
Was that kind of nerve-wracking for you?
Yes, it was. I remember one of the guys saying, if we get torpedoed, I'm going to... He pulled out a gun, shoot whoever panics. And I thought, oh boy, I'm not going to panic.
Yeah.
This guy means it too. So I guess he was in charge of security or something. Yeah, it was pretty scary.
It sounds like it. And I'm guessing there weren't a whole lot of women on the ship.
Seven of us.
And how many men?
About 800.
How'd they treat y'all?
Oh, fine. They really looked out for us. Yeah, they took good care of us.
So you get to Iceland. Did you have a chance to explore any of the natural beauty of Iceland while you were there?
Oh, yes. We went all over, except up to the mountains. We didn't go too far in the mountains. But it was quite an interesting place. Although, why anyone would want to live there, I don't know. Just some of those Scandinavians, that's the people who settled Iceland.
So what did they have you doing there in Iceland?
Just taking care of anybody that came in the hospital. They had a hospital about 12 miles out of Reykjavik, and we just manned the hospital. Accidents and sickness, like, you know.
Not going to be battle casualties in that situation.
No battle casualties there. But, of course, there could have been if there had been anyone rescued, but that North Atlantic was cold. You'd have to get out of it awfully fast to not succumb.
Yeah, if you are torpedoed in a situation like that, your chances of survival are very slim.
Right.
And were you getting used to the Army life? Was it difficult to transition to, or did you?
No. I enjoyed being in the Army. I liked it. Yeah, it was a good life.
So what changed? Why did they take you out of Iceland?
Actually, the troops stayed there quite a while, but they reduced them. There was very few there, and they didn't require... In fact, they didn't require any nurses. They didn't even have a hospital. They just flew anything that really needed care back to the U.S. later, so that they only had a corpsman there to treat minor things. But there wasn't any need for us.
But there would be a need for you in Washington, D.C., I understand.
Went to Washington, D.C., got there at the same time as the Doolittle Raiders came back. So nobody noticed me with them around.
Well, you mentioned that, and I want to talk about you treated some of those guys in the hospital.
Yes.
But can you, for those of us who weren't alive, can you help us understand the significance of the Doolittle Raid for all of America, not just for those guys who pulled it off, but what the symbolic value of what they had done was, what it meant to all of you then?
Right. Well, it opened up and made us realize that we could reach the enemy, and that was a big... And I'm sure they realized it, too. So it was of more psychological than anything else.
You arrived the same day as these guys at Walter Reed?
Practically, yeah. It was the first week in July, I think.
So was there some fanfare for them being there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they got a lot of attention.
And what did you have to do there at Walter Reed? What were your responsibilities?
I was a registered nurse on the officer's ward, so I did nursing there.
How many patients did you have to take care of?
Well, it varied, but usually not more than 10 or so. It was not a high disease time, so we didn't have very many patients.
But a couple of her patients had survived that daring one-way mission from the USS Hornet to Tokyo, and she spent a fair amount of time with those Doolittle Raiders. What about General Jimmy Doolittle himself? You're not going to want to miss this. 100-year-old Jane Boot is our guest today. Find photos and a short video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.